This second progression, from a judge in the head to a mandate of the heart, involves less cynicism about human nature, more hope for us as a group, and also more personal responsibility, and at times, more personal pain. As an illustration, imagine that under some impossibly bizarre set of circumstances, one night you take temporary leave of your senses, sneak over to the house of an especially likable neighbor, and, for no particular reason, murder her cat. Just before daybreak, you recover your senses and realize what you have done. What do you feel? What is the specific nature of your guilty reaction? Unseen behind your living room curtain, you watch your neighbor come out to her front step and discover the cat. She falls to her knees. She scoops up her lifeless pet in her arms. She weeps for a very long time. What is the first thing that happens to you? Does a voice inside your head scream, "Thou shalt not kill. You'll go to jail for this," thus reminding you of the consequences to yourself? Or, instead, do you feel instantly sick that you have murdered an animal and made your neighbor cry in grief? In those first moments of watching your stricken neighbor, which reaction is more likely to befall you? It is a telling question. The answer will probably determine what course of action you will take, and also whether you are influenced only by the strident voice of your superego or by a genuine conscience. The same kind of question applies to our old friend Joe. Does he decide to sacrifice his meeting because of the unconscious fear instilled in him in childhood by his father's opinions about dogs? Or does he make the sacrifice because he feels awful when he thinks about Reebok's predicament? What directs his choice? Is it pure superego, or is it fully formed conscience? If it is conscience, then Joe's decision to be absent from a scheduled meeting at work is a minor illustration of the fact that, ironically, conscience does not always follow the rules. It places people, and sometimes animals, above codes of conduct and institutional expectations. Fortified with potent emotions, conscience is a glue that holds us together, and it is stickier than it is just. It cherishes humanistic ideals more than laws, and if push comes to shove, conscience may even go to prison. Superego would never do that. A strict superego berates us, saying, "You're being naughty," or "You're inadequate." A strong conscience insists, "You must take care of him, or her, or it, or them, no matter what." Fear-based superego stays behind its dark curtain, accusing us and wringing its hands. Conscience propels us outward in the direction of other people, toward conscious action, both minor and great. Attachment-based conscience causes the teenage mother to buy the little jar of creamed peas instead of her favorite fingernail polish. Conscience protects the privileges of intimacy, makes friends keep their promises, prevents the angered spouse from striking back. It induces the exhausted doctor to pick up the phone for his frightened patient at 3 a.m. It blows whistles against institutions when lives are endangered. It takes to the streets to protest a war. Conscience is what makes the human rights worker risk her very life. When it is combined with surpassing moral courage, it is Mother Teresa, Mahatma Gandhi, Nelson Mandela, Aung San Suu Kyi. In small and large ways, genuine conscience changes the world. Rooted in emotional connectedness, it teaches peace and opposes hatred and saves children. It keeps marriages together and cleans up rivers and feeds dogs and gives gentle replies. It makes individual lives better and increases human dignity overall. It is real and compelling, and it would make us crawl out of our skin if we devastated our neighbor. The problem, as we are about to see, is that not everyone has it. In fact, 4% of all people do not have it. Let us turn now to a discussion of such a person, someone who simply has no conscience, and see what he looks like to us. Chapter 2. Ice People, the Sociopaths. Conscience is the window of our spirit. Evil is the curtain. Doug Horton. When Skip was growing up, his family had a vacation cottage by a small lake in the hills of Virginia, where they went for a part of each summer. They vacationed there from the time Skip was 8 years old until he went away to high school in Massachusetts. Skip looked forward to his summers in Virginia. There was not a lot to do there, but the one activity he had invented was so much fun that it made up for the general lack of excitement. In fact, sometimes back at grade school in the winter, escaping into his own thoughts while some stupid teacher went on and on about something, he would get a picture of himself playing his game by the warm Virginia lake, and he would chuckle out loud. Skip was brilliant and handsome, even as a child. Brilliant and handsome, his parents and his parents' friends, and even his teachers would remark over and over. And so they could not understand why his grades were so mediocre, or why, when the time came, he seemed to have so little interest in going out on dates. What they did not know was that from the age of 11, Skip had been out with plenty of girls, but not quite in the way his parents and teachers were imagining. There was always someone, usually an older girl, who was willing to succumb to Skip's flattery and his charming smile. Often the girl would sneak him into her room, but sometimes he and a girl would simply find a secluded spot on a playground or under the bleachers at the softball field. As for his grades, he really was extremely smart. He could have made straight A pluses, but getting C's was completely effortless, and so that was what he did. Occasionally, he would even get a B, which amused him, since he never studied. The teachers liked him, seemed to be almost as vulnerable to his smiles and his compliments as the girls were, and everyone assumed that young Skipper would end up at a good high school and then a decent college, despite his grades. His parents had a great deal of money, were mega rich, as the other kids put it. On several occasions when he was about 12, Skip sat at the antique roll-top desk his parents had bought for his bedroom, trying to calculate how much money he would get when they died. He based his calculations on some financial records he had stolen from his father's study. The records were confusing and incomplete, but even though he could not arrive at an exact figure, Skip could see clearly that someday he would be quite rich. Still, Skip had a problem. He was bored most of the time. The amusements he pursued, even the girls, even fooling the teachers, even thinking about his money, did not keep him energized for longer than half an hour or so. The family wealth held the most promise as an entertainment, but it was not under his control yet. He was still a child. No, the only real relief from boredom was the fun he could have in Virginia. Vacations were a very good time. The first summer, when he was 8, he had simply stabbed the bullfrogs with the scissors for want of another method. He had discovered that he could take a net from the fishing shed and capture the frogs easily from the mud banks of the lake. He would hold them down on their backs, stab their bulging stomachs, and then turn them back over to watch their stupid jelly eyes go dead as they bled out. Then he would hurl the corpses as far out onto the lake as he could, yelling at the dead frogs as they flew, "Too bad for you, you little fuck-faced froggy." There were so many frogs in that lake, he could spend hours at a time killing them, and still it looked as if there were hundreds and hundreds of them left for tomorrow. But by the end of that first summer, Skip had decided that he could do better. He was tired of stabbing the frogs. It would be so great to blow them up, to have something that would make the fat little squirmers explode, and toward this end, he had a really good plan. He knew plenty of older boys back home, and one in particular he knew took a family trip to South Carolina during spring break every April. Skip had heard that fireworks were for sale and easy to get in South Carolina. With a little bribe from Skip, his friend Tim would buy him some fireworks there and smuggle them home in the bottom of his suitcase. Tim would be scared to do it, but with a pep talk from Skip and enough money, he would. Next summer, Skip would not have scissors, but fireworks. Finding cash around the house was no problem, and the plan worked like a charm. That April, he came up with $200 for a fireworks variety pack called Star Spangled Banner, which he had seen in a gun magazine, and another $100 to sweeten the deal for Tim. And when Skip finally got his hands on the package, it was a beautiful thing. He had chosen Star Spangled Banner because it contained the largest number of devices small enough to fit, or almost fit, into the mouth of a bullfrog. There was a supply of tiny Roman candles, and some ladyfingers, which were slim little red firecrackers, and a bunch of 1-inch shells called wizards. And his favorite, some 2-inch shells in a box labeled Mortal Destruction, which had a skull and crossbones blazoned on the front. That summer, he shoved the devices one by one into the mouths of the captured frogs, ignited them, and threw the frogs high into the air over the lake. Or sometimes he would put the ignited frog down, run off, and watch from a distance as the animal exploded on the ground. The displays were magnificent. Blood, goo, lights, sometimes a big noise in those colorful flower-like shapes. So wonderful were the results that soon he began to crave an audience for his genius. One afternoon, he enticed his 6-year-old sister, Claire, down to the lake, let her help him capture one of the frogs, and then before her eyes made an airborne explosion of it. Claire screamed hysterically and ran as fast as her legs would carry her back to the house. The family's stately cottage sat about 1/2 mile from the lake, beyond a serene stand of 100-foot hemlocks. This was not so far away that Skip's parents had not heard explosive noises, and they imagined that Skipper must be setting off fireworks by the lake. But they had long since realized that he was not the sort of child who could be controlled, and that they needed to choose their battles very carefully. The fireworks issue was not one they chose to deal with, not even when 6-year-old Claire came running in to tell her mother that Skipper was blowing up frogs. Skip's mother turned up the record player in the library as loud as it would go, and Claire tried to hide her cat, Emily. Super Skip. Skip is sociopathic. He has no conscience, no intervening sense of obligation based in emotional attachments to others, and his later life, which we will get to in a moment, provides an instructive example of what an intelligent adult without a conscience can look like. Just as it is difficult to imagine how we would feel if we had no conscience at all, so it is very hard to use one's imagination to construct an accurate picture of such a person. Amoral and uncaring, does he end up isolated on the edges of society? Does he constantly threaten and snarl and quite possibly drool, devoid as he is of such a fundamental human characteristic? One might easily imagine that Skip grew up to be a killer. In the end, perhaps he murdered his parents for their money. Maybe he wound up dead himself, or in the bowels of a maximum security prison. Sounds likely, but nothing of the kind actually happened. Skip is still alive, he has never killed anyone, not directly at least, and, so far, he has not seen the inside of any prison. To the contrary, though he has not yet inherited his parents' money, he has become successful and richer than a king. And if you met him now, encountered him as a stranger in a restaurant or on the street, he would look like any other well-groomed middle-aged fellow in a pricey business suit. How could this possibly be? Did he have a recovery? Did he get better? No. In truth, he got worse. He became Super Skip. With passing, if not stellar, grades, his charm and his family's influence, Skip did indeed get into that good boarding school in Massachusetts. And his family breathed a sigh of relief, both for his acceptance by the school and for his relative absence from their lives. His teachers still found him charismatic, but his mother and sister had learned that he was manipulative and spooky. Claire would sometimes speak of Skipper's weird eyes, and her mother would give her a defeated look that said, "I don't want to talk about it." Most everyone else saw only a handsome young face. When college came around, Skip was accepted into his father's alma mater, and his grandfather's before that, where he became legendary as a party boy and a ladies' man. Graduating with his customary C average, he entered an MBA program at a less prestigious institution because he had figured out that the business world was a place where he might master the game easily and amuse himself using his natural skills. His grades got no better, but his lifelong ability to charm people and get them to do what he wanted became more refined. When he was 26, he joined the Eureka Corporation, a company that made blasting, drilling, and loading equipment for metal ore mines. He had intense blue eyes and a stunning smile at all the right moments, and to his new employers, he seemed almost magically talented at motivating sales representatives and influencing contacts. For his part, Skip had discovered that manipulating educated adults was no harder than it had been to convince his young friend Tim to buy fireworks in South Carolina, and of course lying, in increasingly elegant ways, came as easily as breathing. Even better, chronically bored Skip relished the pressures of fast-track risk-taking, and was more than willing to take the big chances that no one else would. Before his 3rd anniversary at the company, he had gone after the copper in Chile and the gold in South Africa, eventually making Eureka into the world's 3rd largest vendor of both shaft and open-pit mining equipment. Eureka's founder, whom Skip privately viewed as a fool, was so enchanted with Skip that he gave him a new Ferrari GTB as a corporate gift. When he was 30, Skip married Juliet, the lovely, soft-spoken 23-year-old daughter of a celebrated millionaire who had made his fortune in oil exploration. Skip made sure that Juliet's father saw him as the brilliant, ambitious son he had never had. Skip saw his billionaire father-in-law as what he was, a ticket to just about everything. And, quite accurately, he saw his new wife, Juliet, as a sweet, repressed gentlewoman who would thoroughly accept her role as wife and social coordinator, and who would pretend not to know that Skip's life remained just as devoid of personal responsibility and full of random sexual encounters as it had ever been. She would be attractive and respectable on his arm, and she would keep her mouth shut. A week before the wedding, Skip's mother, already feeling closer to Juliet than to Skip, wearily inquired of her son, "This marriage, do you really need to do this to her life?" Skip started to ignore her, as he usually did. But then he was apparently struck by something funny, and he replied to her protest with an ear-to-ear grin. "We both know she'll never know what hit her," he said. Skip's mother looked confused for a moment, and then she shuddered. Married, socially ensconced, and bringing in close to $80 million a year for Eureka, Skip was made president of its international division and a member of the board before his 36th birthday. By this time, he and Juliet had two little girls, completing his public disguise as a family man. His contributions to the business came with a certain price, but nothing that could not be handled in a cost-efficient manner. Employees sometimes complained that he was insulting or vicious, and Eureka was sued when a secretary claimed he had broken her arm while trying to force her to sit in his lap. The case was settled out of court with $50,000 and a gag order for the secretary. $50,000 was nothing to the company, relatively speaking. He was Super Skip, and his employer understood that he was well worth the upkeep. Of the incident, Skip later remarked privately, "She's insane. She broke her own arm. She struggled with me, stupid bitch. Why the hell did she put up such a fight?" After the secretary, there were additional charges of sexual misconduct, but Skip was so valuable to the organization that each time a problem came up, Eureka simply dispersed another check to make sure it went away. The other board members began to refer to him as their company prima donna. As the years passed, he received grants of more than 1 million shares, making him the second largest individual shareholder after Eureka's founder. And in 2001, at the age of 51, Skip took over as chief executive. More recently, some of his problems have become slightly less manageable, but with his usual arrogance, Skip is confident he will land on his feet, perhaps a little too confident. In 2003, he was accused of fraud by the Securities and Exchange Commission. He denied the charge, of course, and at present the decision of the SEC is pending. Playing the game. No, Skip was not consigned to the edges of society. He does not drool, and he is not yet in prison. In fact, he is rich and in many circles respected, or at least feared, which masquerades brilliantly as respect. So what is wrong with this picture? Or perhaps the question should be, what is the worst part of this picture, the central flaw in Skip's life that makes him into a tragedy despite his success, and into the maker of tragedies for so many others? It is this. Skip has no emotional attachments to other people. None at all. He is cold as ice. His mother is there to be ignored, or sometimes baited. His sister is there to be tormented. Other women are sexual plunder, and nothing more. He has been waiting since childhood for his father to do only one thing, to die and leave his money to Skip. His employees are there to be manipulated and used, as his friends have always been. His wife and even his children are meant for the eyes of the world. They are camouflage. Skip is intellectually gifted, and he is fabulous at the gamesmanship of business. But by far his most impressive talent is his ability to conceal from nearly everyone the true emptiness of his heart and to command the passive silence of those few who do know. Most of us are irrationally influenced by appearance, and Skipper has always looked good. He knows just how to smile. He is charming, and we can readily imagine him showering flattery on the boss who gave him the Ferrari, meanwhile thinking him the fool. And underneath it all, being incapable of gratitude toward anyone. He lies artfully and constantly, with absolutely no sense of guilt that might give him away in body language or facial expression. He uses sexuality as manipulation and hides his emotional vacancy behind various respectable roles, corporate superstar, son-in-law, husband, father, which are nearly impenetrable disguises. And if the charm and the sexuality and the role-playing somehow fail, Skip uses fear, a sure winner. His iciness is fundamentally scary. Robert Hare writes, "Many people find it difficult to deal with the intense, emotionless, or predatory stare of the psychopath." And for some of the more sensitive people in his life, Skip's intense blue eyes, the ones his sister sees as weird, may well be those of the dispassionate hunter gazing at his psychological prey. If so, the result will probably be silence. For even if you know about him, know what his heart is like, and have caught on to his modus operandi, how will you call him out? Whom can you possibly tell? And what will you say? He's a liar? He's crazy? He raped me in his office? He's got spooky eyes? He used to kill frogs? But this is a leader of the community in an Armani suit. This is Juliet's beloved husband and the father of two. This man is the CEO of the Eureka Corporation, for goodness sake. Just what are you accusing him of, and what proof do you have? Who is going to sound crazier, Chief Executive Skip or his accuser? And sealing his invulnerability, there are those who need Skip to be around for one reason or another, including people who are wealthy and powerful. Are they going to care what you say? In his unassailability, and in many other ways, Skip is an exemplary sociopath. He has, in the words of the American Psychiatric Association, a greater than normal need for stimulation. And so he often takes big risks, and he guiltlessly charms others into taking them too. He has a history of undocumented childhood behavior problems, obscured by his parents' social privilege. He is deceitful and manipulative. He can be impulsively aggressive, with a reckless disregard for the safety of others, as he was with the employee whose arm he broke, and with the other women whose stories will never be heard. Perhaps the only classic symptom Skip does not exhibit is substance abuse. The closest he ever comes to that is one too many scotches after dinner. Otherwise, the picture is complete. He is not genuinely interested in bonding with anyone. He is consistently irresponsible, and he has no remorse. And so, how does all of this turn in his mind? What makes him tick? What exactly does Skip want? Most of us have other people to motivate us and to populate our desires. People drive our wishes and our dreams. People who live with us, people who are far away, beloved people who have died, aggravating people who will not leave, places made sentimental by whom we knew there, even our pets. These fill our hearts and our thoughts. Even the most introverted among us is defined by her relationships and preoccupied with reactions to and feelings about, antipathies and affections for, other people. Emotional intrigue, romance, nurturing, rejection, and reunion comprise nearly all of our literature and song. We are overwhelmingly relational creatures, and this is true all the way back to our primate ancestors. Jane Goodall says the chimpanzees she observed in Gom have a rich repertoire of behaviors that serve to maintain or restore social harmony. The embracing, kissing, patting, and holding of hands that serve as greetings after separation. The long, peaceful sessions of relaxed social grooming. The sharing of food. The concern for the sick or wounded. And so, without our primordial attachments to others, what would we be? Evidently, we would be the players of a game, one that resembled a giant chess match, with our fellow human beings as the rooks, the knights, and the pawns. For this is the essence of sociopathic behavior and desire. The only thing Skip really wants, the only thing left, is to win. Skip does not spend any time searching for someone to love he cannot love. He does not worry about friends or family members who may be sick or in trouble, because he cannot worry about other people. He cares nothing for others, and so he cannot enjoy telling his parents or his wife about his many successes in the business world. He can have dinner with whomever he pleases, but he cannot share the moment with anyone at all. And when his children were born, he was not scared, but neither was he excited. He can derive no real joy from being with them or from watching them grow up. But there is one thing Skip can do, and he does this one thing better than almost anyone else. Skip is brilliant at winning. He can dominate. He can bend others to his will. When he was a boy, the frogs died when he decided they should die. His sister screamed when he wanted her to, and now he has gone on to bigger and better games. In a world where people struggle just to make a living, Skip convinced others to make him rich before he was 30. He can make fools of his well-educated employers and even his billionaire father-in-law. He can cause these otherwise sophisticated people to jump and then laugh at them behind their backs. He influences large financial decisions on an international playing field, can turn most such arrangements to his own advantage, and no one protests. Or if someone does complain, he can cut that person off at the knees with just a well-placed word or two. He can frighten people, assault them, break an arm, ruin a career, and his wealthy colleagues will fall all over themselves making sure he never pays the penalties any ordinary person would pay. He believes he can have any woman he wants and manipulate any man he comes across, including, most recently, everyone at the Securities and Exchange Commission. He is Super Skip. Strategies and payoffs are the only thrills he knows, and he has spent his entire life getting better at the game. For Skip, the game is everything, and though he is too shrewd to say so, he thinks the rest of us are naive and stupid for not playing it his way. And this is exactly what happens to the human mind when emotional attachment and conscience are missing, life is reduced to a contest, and other human beings seem to be nothing more than game pieces, to be moved about, used as shields, or ejected. Of course, few individuals equal Skip in the level of his IQ or in his physical appearance. By definition, most people, including sociopaths, are average in intelligence and looks, and the games that average sociopaths play are not in the same elite league as Super Skip's global competitions. Many contemporary psychologists, myself included, recall first learning about psychopathy from an educational movie on the subject, viewed when we were college students in the 1970s. The Nebushi case study in the movie is remembered as Stamp Man because he devoted his whole life to the unlikely project of stealing postage stamps from United States post offices. He was not interested in possessing the stamps or in selling them for cash. His only ambition was to execute a simple break-in at night and then find a spot a little distance from the post office he had just robbed, where he could watch the frenzy of the first employees to enter the building in the morning, followed by the emergency arrival of the police. Skinny, pale, and mouse-like, the man interviewed in the movie was anything but scary. His intelligence was average at most, and he could never have played Skip's grand international game with its masterful strategies and billionaire opponents. But he could play his own game, and psychologically, his simple stamp-stealing game was surprisingly similar to Skip's corporate one. Unlike Skip's, Stamp Man's plans were inelegant and transparent, and he was always discovered and arrested. He had been to court and then to jail countless times, and this was the way he lived his life, robbing, watching, going to jail, getting out of jail, and robbing again. But he was unconcerned, because the eventual outcome of his scheming was irrelevant to him. From his perspective, all that mattered was playing the game and seeing, at least for an hour or so each time, the irrefutable evidence that he, Stamp Man, could make people jump. In Stamp Man's opinion, being able to make people jump meant he was winning, and in this way, no less than phenomenally affluent Skip, he illustrates what a sociopath wants. Controlling others, winning, is more compelling than anything or anyone else. Perhaps the ultimate in dominating another person is to take a life, and the psychopathic murderer or cold-blooded serial killer is the first thing many of us imagine when we think of sociopathic deviance. Short of a sociopathic leader who diverts the course of an entire nation, leading it into genocide or unnecessary war, the psychopathic killer is surely the most terrifying example of a psyche without conscience, the most terrifying example, but not the most common one. Homicidal sociopaths are notorious. We read about them in newspapers, hear about them on television, see them portrayed in films, and we are shaken to our core by the knowledge that in our midst there are sociopathic monsters who can kill without passion or remorse. But contrary to popular belief, most sociopaths are not murderers, at least not in the sense that they kill with their own two hands. We can see this from statistics alone. About 1 in 25 people are sociopathic, but outside of prisons or gangs and other poverty and war-torn groups, the incidence of murderers in our population is, thankfully, far less. When sociopathy and bloodlust come together in the same person, the result is a dramatic, even a cinematic, nightmare, a horror figure who seems larger than life. But most sociopaths are not mass murderers or serial killers. They are not Pol Pot or Ted Bundy. Instead, most are only life-size, like the rest of us, and can remain unidentified for long periods of time. Most people without conscience are more like Skip or Stamp Man, or the mother who uses her children as tools, or the therapist who deliberately disempowers vulnerable patients, or the seduce and manipulate lover, or the business partner who empties the bank account and vanishes, or the charming friend who uses people and insists she has not. The methods sociopaths dream up to control others, the schemes contrived to ensure wins, are quite various, and only a few of them have to do with physical violence. After all, violence is conspicuous, and unless performed against the utterly powerless, such as children or animals, it is likely to get the perpetrator caught. In any case, though they are horrifying when they occur, brutal murders are not the likeliest result of consciouslessness. Rather, the game is the thing. The prize to be won can run the gamut from world domination to a free lunch, but it is always the same game, controlling, making others jump, winning. Evidently, winning in this fashion is all that remains of interpersonal meaning when attachment and conscience are absent. When the value of relationships has been reduced to nearly nothing, dominance is sometimes asserted by murdering people. But more often, it is accomplished by killing frogs, or racking up sexual conquests, or seducing and using friends, or exploiting the copper in Chile, or stealing some postage stamps, just to see people scramble. Do sociopaths know they are sociopaths? Do sociopaths understand what they are? Do they have some insight into their nature, or instead, could they read this book from cover to cover and fail to see themselves reflected? In my work, I'm often asked these kinds of questions, especially by people whose lives have been derailed by collisions with sociopaths whom they did not recognize as such until it was too late. I do not know exactly why the issue of insight assumes so much importance, except perhaps for our feelings that if a person gets through life totally without conscience, he or she should at least acknowledge that very fact. We feel that if someone is bad, he should be burdened with the knowledge that he is bad. It seems to us the ultimate in injustice that a person could be evil, by our assessment, and still feel fine about himself. However, this is exactly what seems to happen. For the most part, people whom we assess as evil tend to see nothing at all wrong with their way of being in the world. Sociopaths are infamous for their refusal to acknowledge responsibility for the decisions they make, or for the outcomes of their decisions. In fact, a refusal to see the results of one's bad behavior as having anything to do with oneself, consistent irresponsibility, in the language of the American Psychiatric Association, is a cornerstone of the antisocial personality diagnosis. Skip illustrated this aspect of his personality when he explained that the employee whose arm he broke had actually broken her own arm when she did not submit to him readily enough. People without conscience provide endless examples of such stunning "I've done nothing wrong" statements. One of the most famous is a quotation from Chicago's sadistic prohibition gangster, Al Capone. "I'm going to St. Petersburg, Florida, tomorrow. Let the worthy citizens of Chicago get their liquor the best they can. I'm sick of the job. It's a thankless one and full of grief. I've been spending the best years of my life as a public benefactor." Other sociopaths do not bother with such convoluted reasoning, or they are not in commanding enough positions to have anyone listen to their outrageous logic. Instead, when confronted with a destructive outcome that is clearly their doing, they will say, plain and simple, I never did that, and will to all appearances believe their own direct lie. This feature of sociopathy makes self-awareness impossible, and in the end, just as the sociopath has no genuine relationships with other people, he has only a very tenuous one with himself. If anything, people without conscience tend to believe their way of being in the world is superior to ours. They often speak of the naivete of other people and their ridiculous scruples, or of their curiosity about why so many people are unwilling to manipulate others, even in the service of their most important ambitions. Or they theorize that all people are the same, unscrupulous like them, but are dishonestly play-acting something mythical called conscience. By this latter proposition, the only straightforward and honest people in the world are they themselves. They are being real in a society of phonies. Still, I believe that somewhere buried safely away from consciousness, there may be a faint internal murmuring that something is missing, something that other people have. I say this because I have heard sociopaths speak of feeling empty or even hollow. And I say this because what sociopaths envy and may seek to destroy as a part of the game is usually something in the character structure of a person with conscience, and strong characters are often specially targeted by sociopaths. And most of all, I say this because it is human beings who are targeted rather than the earth itself or some aspect of the material world. Sociopaths want to play their games with other people. Even the destruction of the World Trade Towers was mainly about the people who were in them and the people who would see and hear about the catastrophe. This simple but crucial observation implies that in sociopathy there remains some innate identification with other human beings, a tie with the species itself. However, this thin, inborn connection, which enables envy, is one-dimensional and sterile, especially when contrasted with the vast array of complex and highly charged emotional responses most people have to one another and to their fellow human beings as a group. If all you ever felt toward another person were the cold wish to win, how would you understand the meaning of love, of friendship, of caring? You would not understand. You would simply go on dominating and denying and feeling superior. Perhaps you would experience a little emptiness sometimes, a remote sense of dissatisfaction, but that is all. And with the wholesale denial of your true impact on other people, how would you understand who you were? Once again, you would not. Like Super Skip himself, Super Skip's mirror can tell only lies. His glass does not show him the iciness of his soul, and the Skip who spent his childhood summers mutilating bullfrogs by an otherwise peaceful Virginia lake will eventually go to his grave not understanding that his life could have been full of meaning and warmth. Chapter 3. When Normal Conscience Sleeps. The price of freedom is eternal vigilance. Thomas Jefferson. Conscience is a creator of meaning. As a sense of constraint rooted in our emotional ties to one another, it prevents life from devolving into nothing but a long and essentially boring game of attempted dominance over our fellow human beings. And for every limitation conscience imposes on us, it gives us a moment of connectedness with an other, a bridge to someone or something outside of our often meaningless schemes. Considering the ice-cold alternative of being someone like Skip, conscience is devoutly to be wished. So the question arises, in the 96% of us who are not sociopathic, does conscience ever change? Does it ever waver or weaken or die? The truth is that even a normal person's conscience does not operate on the same level all of the time. One of the simplest reasons for this changeability is the fundamental circumstances of living inside a fallible, need-driven human body. When our bodies are exhausted, sick, or injured, all of our emotional functions, including conscience, can be temporarily compromised. To illustrate this, as he drives along in his car, let us give Attorney Joe, owner of Reebok, a dizzying fever of about 102 degrees. We can see right away that his common sense is faltering, since, sick as he is still trying to get to his meeting at work. But what about his moral sense? As a pitiless virus takes possession of his body, what does Joe do when he remembers that his dog Reebok, whom he loves, has no food? In this version of the story, Joe may barely have enough energy to go through with the plans he has already made, let alone be able to think quickly, prioritize on the spot, and redirect himself, as he does in the non-sick Joe scenario. Feverish and queasy, now his emotional reaction to Reebok's distress is in direct competition with his own misery. Maybe conscience will still prevail. On the other hand, maybe Joe, weakened by illness, no longer possesses the complete strength of his convictions. Following the course of least resistance, maybe he will just keep driving and try to suffer through his original plans, and Reebok, though not altogether forgotten, will be relegated to an emotional back burner for a while. This is not really how we want to think about Joe, or about ourselves, but it is interesting, and it is true. Our exalted sense of conscience, the bringer of connection and meaning, can at times be significantly affected by something as totally irrelevant to right versus wrong, as unrelated to our moral sensibilities, as the flu, or a missed night's sleep, or a car crash, or a toothache. Normal conscience never disappears, but when the body is weak, conscience can get very sleepy and unfocused. An assault to the body is one of two things, the other one being great fear, that elevate continued wide-awake conscience to an heroic level in our eyes. If a person is acutely ill or seriously injured or afraid and yet remains true to his or her emotional attachments, we think of that person as courageous. The classic example is the frontline soldier who, though injured himself, rescues his comrade from enemy fire. That we insist on the concept of courage to describe such acts is our tacit acknowledgement that the voice of conscience is commonly outshouted by substantial pain or fear. And in order to care for Reebok, if Joe were to make an extra drive home, even with a fever of 102, we might see his behavior as heroic in a minor way. We would do more than just smile at him sentimentally. We might want to pat him on the back. Another bodily influence on conscience is, strangely enough, hormones. To relate this impairment of conscience succinctly, according to figures from the National Adoption Information Clearinghouse, 15% to 18% of recent births in the United States were unwanted by the mother at the time of conception. It is fair to assume that some of these pregnancies resulted from ignorance or genuine accident, but to be sure, hundreds of thousands of brand new Americans are now living the insecure existence of unwanted children simply because a physical appetite eclipsed their parents' consciences for just a few minutes in each case. When speaking of sexual pressures, we acknowledge how difficult it can be to argue with our biological nature, and we raise instances of sustained conscience to the lofty designation of virtue. Noteworthy is that, by this definition, we are often more virtuous at 40 than we were at 20, and this virtue is achieved merely through aging. There are tragic biological subversions of conscience as well. These include the various schizophrenic disorders that sometimes cause individuals to act based on psychotic delusions. When the human brain is impaired in this way, the voices told me to do it is not a joke, but a horrifying reality, and for the haunted soul whose psychosis waxes and wanes over time, there is the possibility of waking from insanity to find that he has acted on a delusional idea against his own conscience and will. Fortunately, the pressures our bodies bring to bear on conscience are fairly circumscribed. Outside of combat, situations in which we must make crucial moral decisions while we are severely injured do not happen to us every day, or even every year, and for most people, sexual enthrallment is similarly infrequent. Out-of-control paranoid schizophrenia is relatively rare. Even taken together, the biological limitations on our moral sense do not account for very much of the incomprehensibly bad behavior we can read about in our newspapers or see on our televisions any hour of any day. Schizophrenics are unlikely to be organized terrorists. Toothaches do not cause hate crimes. Unprotected sex does not start wars. So what does? Moral exclusion. Each year, on the 4th of July, the little seaside New England town where I live lights a 3-story celebratory bonfire on the beach. Pallets of dry wood are nailed together and artfully stacked on top of one another in a tower-like shape that dominates our quaint landscape for several days before the 4th. The tower is constructed just so, with enough planks of wood and enough space for airflow in between, that it can be counted on to flame up quickly. It is ignited as darkness falls, with the volunteer fire department standing by, hoses at the ready, just in case. The atmosphere is festive. The band plays patriotic songs. There are hot dogs and Slurpees and a fireworks display. When the bonfire is burned out completely, the children return to the beach, where the firemen obligingly drench them with their hoses. All of this has been a town tradition for 60 years, but not being a big fan of massive fires, I have attended it only once, in 2002, when I was encouraged by friends. I was amazed by the numbers of people who had somehow pressed themselves into our tiny corner of the Atlantic coastline, some of them from 50 or more miles away, and I jostled with the crowd to find a spot close enough to see the fire, but far enough away not to get my eyebrows singed, or so I thought. I'd been warned that once the fire got going, there would be more heat than I could imagine, and it was already a 90-degree day. As the sun began to set, there were hoots and shouts and calls for the tower to be torched, and when flame was finally put to wood, there was a collective gasp. The fire immediately began to engulf the wooden structure like the unstoppable force it was, from the sand upward to a night sky that suddenly blazed, and then came the heat. With the feel of a near-solid object, a wall of unbearable, even frightening, superheated air rolled outward from the fire in waves of increasing intensity, taking the crowd by surprise and pushing us away en masse. Each time I thought I was far enough away, I had to move back another 50 yards, and then another 50 yards, and then another. My face hurt. I would never have dreamed that a bonfire could make that much heat, not even one that was 3 stories high. Once people had retreated to a sufficient distance, a sense of happy fascination returned, and when the ornamental top of the tower was consumed by the fire, the crowd applauded. The ornament at the summit had been built to resemble a little house, and now the house contained a miniature inferno. This and the vague sense of danger and the heat all disturbed me somehow, and I could not seem to share the feeling of a festive occasion. Instead, perversely, I began to think about the reality of the witch burnings in the 16th and 17th century, events I have always thought of as incomprehensible, and hot as I was, I shivered a little. It is one thing to read about a fire large enough to execute a human being. It is another thing to stand in front of such a fire, along with an excited, hooting crowd. The sinister historical associations would not leave me, and stubbornly kept me from taking any delight in the moment. I wondered, how had the witch burnings happened? How could such nightmares have been real? Ever the psychologist, I looked around at the people. Clearly, these were not bewildered Basque refugees in 1610, frantically searching for diabolists to burn. Here we were, a crowd of new millennium, peace-loving, non-hysterical citizens, unscarred by hardship or menacing superstition. There was no bloodlust here, or subjugation of conscience. There was laughter and neighborly feeling. We were eating hot dogs and drinking Slurpees and celebrating Independence Day. We were not a heartless, amoral mob, and we would by no means have rallied around a murder, let alone the staging of a torture. If by some bizarre reality warp there had suddenly been a human figure writhing in those colossal flames, only the anonymous handful of sociopaths among us would have been unaffected or perhaps entertained. Of the rest, a few good people would have stared in paralyzed disbelief, a number of especially courageous people would have tried to intervene, and most of the crowd would have fled in understandable terror. And the once cheerful bonfire would have become a traumatic image, seared into all of our brains for the rest of our lives. But what if the burning human figure had been Osama bin Laden? How would this crowd of American nationals in 2002 have reacted if suddenly confronted with the public execution of the person identified by them as the world's most despicable villain? Would these normally conscience-bound, church-going, nonviolent people have stood by and allowed it? Might there have been enthusiasm, or at least acquiescence, rather than nausea and horror at the spectacle of a human being dying in agony? Standing there, among all these good people, I suddenly realized that the reaction might have been something less than horror, simply because Osama bin Laden is not a human being in our view. He is Osama, and as such, to borrow an expression from Irvin Staub in The Roots of Evil, he has been completely excluded from our moral universe. The interventions of conscience no longer apply to him. He is not human, he is an it. And unfortunately, this transformation of a man into an it makes him scarier as well. Sometimes people appear to deserve our moral exclusion of them, as terrorists appear to do. Other examples of its are war criminals, child abductors, and serial killers. And in each of these cases, a considered argument can be, and has been made, rightly or wrongly, that certain rights to compassionate treatment have been forfeited. But in most cases, our tendency to reduce people to non-beings is neither considered nor conscious, and throughout history our proclivity to dehumanize has too often been turned against the essentially innocent. The list of outgroups that some portion of humankind has at one time or another demoted to the status of hardly even human is extremely long, and ironically includes categories for nearly every one of us. Blacks, communists, capitalists, gays, Native Americans, Jews, foreigners, witches, women, Muslims, Christians, the Palestinians, the Israelis, the poor, the rich, the Irish, the English, the Americans, the Sinhalese, Tamils, Albanians, Croats, Serbs, Hutus, Tutsis, and Iraqis, to name but a few. And once the other group has become populated by its, anything goes, especially if someone in authority gives the order. Conscience is no longer necessary, because conscience binds us to other beings and not to its. Conscience still exists, may even be very exacting, but it applies only to my countrymen, my friends, and my children, not yours. You are excluded from my moral universe, and with impunity, and maybe even praise from the others in my group, I can now drive you from your home, or shoot your family, or burn you alive. I should record that nothing bad actually happened at the bonfire in 2002. As far as I know, these macabre thoughts occurred only to me. The flames consumed only wood. The fire was a sight to behold, and then burned itself out, just as planned. Laughing children, safe in their hometown, romped on the beach and got doused by the firemen. One wishes that human gatherings could always be as peaceful. The Emperor's New Clothes. When conscience falls into a profound trance, when it sleeps through acts of torture, war, and genocide, political leaders and other prominent individuals can make the difference between a gradual reawakening of our seventh sense and a continued amoral nightmare. History teaches that attitudes and plans coming from the top, dealing pragmatically with problems of hardship and insecurity in the group, rather than scapegoating an outgroup, can help us return to a more realistic view of the others. In time, moral leadership can make a difference, but history shows us also that a leader with no seventh sense can hypnotize the group conscience still further, redoubling catastrophe. Using fear-based propaganda to amplify a destructive ideology, such a leader can bring the members of a frightened society to see the its as the sole impediment to the good life, for themselves and maybe even for humanity as a whole, and the conflict as an epic battle between good and evil. Once these beliefs have been disseminated, crushing the its without pity or conscience can, with chilling ease, become an incontrovertible mandate. The recurrence throughout history of this second type of leader raises a long list of dumbfounding questions. Why does the human race tolerate this sorrowful story over and over, like a mindless broken record? Why do we continue to allow leaders who are motivated by self-interest or by their own psychological issues from the past to fan bitterness and political crisis into armed confrontation and war? In the worst instances, why do we let people who think like frog-killing, arm-breaking Skip run the show and play games of dominance with other people's lives? What becomes of our individual consciences? Why do we not stand up for what we feel? One explanation is our trance-like state, which lets us believe that the ones who are dying are only its anyway. And there is fear, of course, always, and often a sense of helplessness. We look around at the crowd and we think to ourselves, too many are against me, or I don't hear any other people protesting this, or even more resignedly, that's just the way the world is, or that's politics. All of these feelings and beliefs can significantly mute our moral sense, but where the disabling of conscience by authority is concerned, there is something even more effective, something more elemental than objectifying the others, more cloying and miserable than a sense of helplessness, and evidently more difficult to conquer than fear itself. Very simply, we are programmed to obey authority, even against our own consciences. In 1961 and 1962 in New Haven, Connecticut, Yale University professor Stanley Milgram designed and filmed one of the most astonishing psychological experiments ever conducted. Milgram set out to pit the human tendency to obey authority as squarely as possible against individual conscience. Concerning his method of inquiry, he wrote, "Of all moral principles, the one that comes closest to being universally accepted is this: one should not inflict suffering on a helpless person who is neither harmful nor threatening to oneself. This principle is the counterforce we shall set in opposition to obedience." Milgram's experimental procedure was relentlessly straightforward, and the filmed version of his study has outraged humanists and unsuspecting college students for 40 years. In the study, two men, strangers to each other, arrive at a psychology laboratory to participate in an experiment that has been advertised as having to do with memory and learning. Participation is rewarded with $4 plus 50 cents for car fare. At the lab, the experimenter, Stanley Milgram himself in the filmed version, explains to both men that the study concerns the effects of punishment on learning. One of the two is designated as the learner and is escorted into another room and seated in a chair. All watch as the learner's arms are matter-of-factly strapped to the chair to prevent excessive movement, and an electrode is attached to his wrist. He is told that he must learn a list of word pairs, blue box, nice day, wild duck, etc., and that whenever he makes a mistake, he will receive an electric shock. With each mistake, the shock will increase in intensity. The other person is told that he is to be the teacher in this learning experiment. After the teacher has watched the learner get strapped to a chair and wired for electric shock, the teacher is taken into a different room and asked to take a seat in front of a large, ominous machine called a shock generator. The shock generator has 30 switches, arranged horizontally and labeled by volts, from 15 volts all the way to 450 volts in 15-volt increments. In addition to the numbers, the switches are branded with descriptors that range from slight shock to the sinister appellation of danger, severe shock. The teacher is handed the list of word pairs and told that his job is to administer a test to the learner in the other room. When the learner gets an answer right, for example, teacher calls out blue and learner answers box, the teacher can move on to the next test item. But when the learner gives an incorrect answer, the teacher must push a switch and give him an electric shock. The experimenter instructs the teacher to begin at the lowest level of shock on the shock generator, and with each wrong answer, to increase the shock level by one increment. The learner in the other room is actually the experimenter's trained confederate, an actor, and will receive no shocks at all. But of course, the teacher does not know this, and it is the teacher who is the real subject of the experiment. The teacher calls out the first few items of the learning test, and then trouble begins, because the learner, Milgram's accomplice, unseen in the other room, starts to sound very uncomfortable. At 75 volts, the learner makes a mistake on the word pair, the teacher administers the shock, and the learner grunts. At 120 volts, the learner shouts to the experimenter that the shocks are becoming painful. And at 150 volts, the unseen learner demands to be released from the experiment. As the shocks get stronger, the learner's protests sound more and more desperate. And at 285 volts, he emits an agonized scream. The experimenter, the Yale professor in the white lab coat, stands behind the teacher, who is seated at the shock generator, and calmly gives a sequence of scripted prods, such as, "Please continue," or, "The experiment requires that you continue," or, "Whether the learner likes it or not, you must go on until he has learned all the word pairs correctly. So please go on." Milgram repeated this procedure 40 times using 40 different subjects, people who were, in everyday life, responsible and decent, including high school teachers, postal clerks, salesmen, manual laborers, and engineers. The 40 represented various educational levels, from one man who had not finished high school to others who had doctoral or other professional degrees. The aim of the experiment was to discover how long the subjects, the teachers in this experiment, would take to disobey Milgram's authority when presented with a clear moral imperative. How much electric shock would they administer to a pleading, screaming stranger merely because an authority figure told them to do so? When I show Milgram's film to a lecture hall full of psychology students, I ask them to predict the answers to these questions. The students are always certain that conscience will prevail. Many of them predict that a large number of the subjects will walk out of the experiment as soon as they find out about the use of electric shock. Most of the students are sure that of the subjects who remain, all but a few will defy the experimenter, perhaps telling him to go to hell, at least by the time the man in the other room demands to be freed at 150 volts. And of course, the students predict only a tiny number of very sick, sadistic subjects will continue pushing switches all the way to 450 volts, where the machine itself says danger, severe shock. Here's what actually happens. 34 of Milgram's original 40 subjects continue to shock the learner, whom they believe to be strapped to a chair, even after he asks to be released from the experiment. In fact, of these 34 subjects, 25, that is to say 62.5% of the total group, never disobey the experimenter at any point, continuing to press the switches all the way to the end of the sequence, 450 volts, despite entreaties and shrieks from the man in the other room. The teachers sweat, they complain, they hold their heads, but they continue. When the film is over, I watch the clock. In a lecture hall full of students who have just seen this experiment for the first time, there is always stunned silence for at least one full minute. After the original experiment, Milgram varied his design in a number of ways. In one variation, for example, subjects were not commanded to operate the switches that shocked the learner, only to call out the words for the word pair test before another person pushed the switches. In this version of the experiment, 37 of 40 people, 92.5%, continued to participate to the highest shock level in the generator. Thus far, the teachers in the study had been only men. Milgram now tried his experiment using 40 women, speculating that women might be more empathic. Their performance was virtually identical, except that obedient women reported more stress than obedient men. Studies using the Milgram model were repeated at several other universities and soon involved more than 1,000 subjects of both genders and from many walks of life. The results remained essentially the same. The many times replicated outcomes of his obedience study led Milgram to make the famous pronouncement that has haunted and also motivated so many students of human nature. A substantial proportion of people do what they are told to do, irrespective of the content of the act, and without limitations of conscience, so long as they perceive that the command comes from a legitimate authority. Milgram believed that authority could put conscience to sleep, mainly because the obedient person makes an adjustment of thought, which is to see himself as not responsible for his own actions. In his mind, he is no longer a person who must act in a morally accountable way, but the agent of an external authority to whom he attributes all responsibility and all initiative. This adjustment of thought makes it much easier for benign leadership to establish order and control, but by the same psychological mechanism, it has countless times rolled out the red carpet for self-serving, malevolent, and sociopathic authorities. Where conscience draws the line. The extent to which authority dulls conscience is affected by the perceived legitimacy of that authority. If the person giving the orders is seen as a subordinate or even as an equal, the same adjustment of thought may never occur. In Milgram's initial study, one of the minority of people who eventually refused to continue with the experiment was a 32-year-old engineer who apparently regarded the scientist in the lab coat as, at most, his intellectual peer. This subject pushed his chair away from the shock generator and in an indignant tone said to Milgram, "I'm an electrical engineer and I have had shocks. I think I've gone too far already, probably." In an interview later, when Milgram asked him who was accountable for shocking the man in the other room, he did not assign any responsibility to the experimenter. Instead, he replied, "I would put it on myself entirely." He was a professional person with an advanced education, and education must be acknowledged as one of the factors that determine whether or not conscience stays alert. It would be a grave and arrogant mistake to imagine that an academic degree directly increases the strength of conscience in the human psyche. On the other hand, education can sometimes level the perceived legitimacy of an authority figure and thereby limit unquestioning obedience. With education and knowledge, the individual may be able to hold on to the perception of him or herself as a legitimate authority. Relatedly, in another permutation of his experiment, Milgram posed an ordinary man, rather than a scientist, as the person who ordered the subjects to administer shocks. When an ordinary man was in charge, instead of a man in a white lab coat, obedience on the part of the subjects dropped from 62.5% to 20%. Packaging and perceptions are not everything, but evidently they get pretty close. Some of us may resist a person who looks like we do, but most of us will obey someone who looks like an authority. This finding is of particular concern in an age when our leaders and experts come to us via the magic of television, where nearly anyone can be made to look patrician and commandingly larger than life. In addition to being larger than life, images on television are up close and personal. They are in our living rooms. And another factor that affects authorities' power to overwhelm individual conscience is the proximity of the person giving the commands. When Milgram varied his experiments such that he was not in the room, obedience dropped by 2/3 to about the same level as when an ordinary man was in charge. And when authority was not close by, subjects tended to cheat by using only the lower shock levels on the machine. The nearness of authority is especially relevant to the real-life obedience requirements of combat and war. As it turns out, individual conscience draws a surprisingly firm line at killing, surprising for those who think of human beings as natural war makers. This aspect of conscience is so resilient in normal people that military psychologists have needed to devise ways around it. For example, military experts now know that to make men kill with any kind of reliability, commands must be given by authorities who are present with the troops. Otherwise, the men in the field will tend to cheat on their orders to kill, will intentionally misaim, or simply fail to fire to keep from violating this mightiest prescription of conscience. Brigadier General S. L. A. Marshall was a United States combat historian in the Pacific Theater during World War II and later became the official historian of the European Theater of Operations. He wrote of many World War II incidents in which almost all soldiers obeyed and fired their weapons while their leaders were present to command them, but when the leaders left, the firing rate dropped immediately to between 15 and 20%. Marshall believed that the great relief displayed by soldiers in a sector where they were not being directly ordered to fire was due not so much to the realization that things were safer there as to the blessed knowledge that for a time they were not under the compulsion to take life. In his book, On Killing, The Psychological Cost of Learning to Kill in War and Society, former U.S. Army Ranger and paratrooper, Lieutenant Colonel Dave Grossman, reviews Marshall's observations, along with the FBI's studies of non-firing rates among law enforcement officers in the 1950s and 1960s, and observations of non-firing from a long list of wars, including the American Civil War, World Wars I and II, the Vietnam War, and the Falklands War. He concludes that the vast majority of combatants throughout history, at the moment of truth when they could and should kill the enemy, have found themselves to be conscientious objectors. After weighing the considerable historical evidence that ground soldiers often resist and quietly sabotage opportunities to kill, Grossman comes to a novel and reassuring conclusion about the nature of man. Despite an unbroken tradition of violence and war, man is not by nature a killer. to subvert the bottom line of conscience, to be able to thrust a bayonet or pull a trigger to kill a stranger, normal human beings must be carefully taught, psychologically conditioned, and commanded by authorities on the battlefield. Also, it helps to encourage moral exclusion, to remind the troops that the enemy soldiers are nothing but its, krauts, slants, gooks. As Peter Watson writes in War on the Mind, The Military Uses and Abuses of Psychology, the stupidity of local customs is ridiculed, and local personalities are presented as evil demigods. On and off the battlefield, for both the troops and the people back home, the particular war being fought must be portrayed as a crucial or even a sacred struggle between good and evil, which is exactly the message that authorities, on all sides of the conflict, have tried to convey during every major war in history. For example, though it is now difficult to remember anything but the moral outrage that exploded during the final phases of the Vietnam War, as that war began, Americans were repeatedly assured that they and only they could save the South Vietnamese people from a future of terror and enslavement.